and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the massive trove of leaked documents on offshore tax dodgers and kleptocrats published by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, the Pandora Papers, Offshore Havens and Hidden Riches of World Leaders and Billionaires Exposed in Unprecedented Leak. Joining us from the UK to discuss the inner workings of this shadow economy and the three Malibu beachfront mansions worth $68 million Jordan's King secretly bought, the shadow on the French Riviera purchased by the Czech Prime Minister, who ran as an anti-corruption candidate, and the $100 million Putin's mistress has stashed offshore, is Oliver Bulow. He is the author of Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And we will discuss his article at The Guardian, The Government Promised to Clamp Down on Shell Companies, It Has Failed to Do So, and How the State of South Dakota Has Become an Onshore Haven for Dirty Money. Then we'll look into the devastating oil spill off Huntington Beach in Southern California, in which 126,000 gallons from an offshore platform's broken oil pipeline has spilled into the ocean, killing fish and birds, and is threatening marine mammals, breeding grounds, and ecosystems. Joining us is Gwen Goodman-Lowe, a lecturer in the Marine Biology Department at Long Beach State University, who is an expert on marine mammals, whose research focuses on the effects of contaminants on seals, whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Then finally, with Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp down today, Monday, we will assess the impact of the 60 Minutes appearance on Sunday night by Frances Haugen, a Facebook data scientist who charged the social media giant Facebook with moral bankruptcy for turning off safeguards in place over the election to prevent disinformation and hate speech, which led to the rousing up of the rabble who stormed the Capitol on January the 6th. Joining us is Jonathan Taplin, an author, music and film producer and director emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, who in his book Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, warned about the need to rein in Facebook's monopolistic economic clout and to stop its magnification of hate and misinformation by making it take responsibility for its content as a publisher. And before we go to our first guest, while Background Briefing remains a nationally syndicated radio program with a growing national and international audience, we are relying more and more on our online and podcast audience to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from the UK is Oliver Bulow, who is a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. He's the author of two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Government Promised to Clamp Down on Shell Companies, It Has Failed to Do So. Welcome to Background Briefing, Oliver Bulow.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, thanks for joining us. And we've had the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, and now we have the Pandora Papers. So how much has Pandora's box been opened?
Well, yeah, I mean, if your listeners feel like they've heard or read this story before, then that's because they have. You know, the essential details of the scandal that are being exposed today and tomorrow and will be for the rest of this week, I suppose, will be essentially broadly the same as what was exposed in the Panama Papers, which was the big leak from the Panamanian law firm 5 years ago, and the Paradise Papers and other sort of smaller leaks that have taken place over the last, you know, decade or so. You know, has Pandora's box been opened? Well, I mean, yes, it has, but I suppose it's only new examples of one giant mega scandal, which is the existence of this, I suppose you could call it a shadow financial system that is only available to people able to afford the cost of admission. I call it Moneyland in my book, but essentially what it is, if you're wealthy enough to afford the services of good lawyers and accountants, then you get to dodge out of paying the taxes or suffering the kind of scrutiny that the rest of us face.
And the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, who published the Pandora Papers, Offshore Havens and Hidden Riches of World Leaders and Billionaires Exposed in Unprecedented Leaks, they estimate that the offshore wealth, the tax avoidance, globally is about $11.3 trillion. That's a lot more than's being argued over here in the United States over the various competing infrastructure bills before the Senate, where Joe Biden's and the Democrats' futures hang in the balance of whether they can pass a $3.5 trillion infrastructure package here, considerably less than $11.3 trillion.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a truly colossal sum of money worldwide. And I suppose it's worth just stopping briefly and pausing and saying what a trillion is. You know, I certainly for me, when you start getting into big numbers that end in illion, I struggle to remember what they all are. But a trillion is a million times a million. If you had $1 trillion in a big pile in front of you and you started counting them now, you wouldn't get done for about 30,000 years. In fact, if the first modern humans who arrived in North America had started counting the moment they set foot in Alaska, they wouldn't have got to a trillion by now. It's a really colossal amount of money. And yeah, as you say, whether it's 11 or 12 or 10, in a way, it doesn't really matter. It's still going to be a colossal sum of money. And it's worth bearing in mind where that money is being stolen from, because although a very large quantity of it is evaded taxes in the US or the European Union or the UK or in other Western nations, the real damage is being done in places like Russia, places like Ukraine, places like Angola, you know, really kleptocracies or places with major problems with their corrupted elite, where the elite is able to steal almost anything that they want to the detriment of the democratic system or any prospect of prosperous development in those countries. Corruption is a blight on the most vulnerable people in the world. And it is to the lasting shame of all Western nations, but I think particularly the US and the UK, that they facilitate and sit over the headquarters, if you will, of the shadow financial system revealed in the Pandora Papers.
But what's revealed in the Pandora Papers that surprised me is that the United States is also an offshore shell company. The state of South Dakota has offered itself up and its services up to these very same tax dodgers.
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting, I use the word interesting in the broadest sense, an interesting new phenomenon, or relatively new. It's about, 13 or 14 years old. A number of US states have been attempting to attract this kind of business to outcompete places like the Cayman Islands or Panama itself for a long time. But they've really struggled because, you know, there aren't many, you know, international kleptocrats or tax dodgers who've wanted to put money in the US because, you know, the FBI has a bit of a record of investigating these kind of crimes, and putting your money in the US is a bit like putting your honey in a cave inhabited by a large and particularly powerful bear. But, in the aftermath of the 2007-08 financial crisis, global governments all got together and agreed to exchange information about the assets of each other's citizens in order to prevent them dodging taxes. This stopped places like Switzerland being able to hide money like they used to be able to. But one country, one major country, didn't sign up for this deal, and that country was the United States. So essentially these days, if you want to dodge scrutiny, you don't put your money in the Cayman Islands anymore or in Switzerland or in one of the UK's Channel Islands. You put your money in the US. And there are a number of states that are particularly favorable for that. Nevada has a good go at attracting this money, but really the most attractive one for all sorts of reasons is the improbable tax haven of South Dakota, a little tax haven on the prairie. I visited it in 3 or 4 years ago to write about this issue. And to be honest, no one there really knew this was going on. But the amount of money in South Dakota is piling up and piling up. It's going up and up and up all the time.
And again, I'm speaking with Oliver Bullough, who joins us from the UK. He's a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times and GQ. He's authored two nonfiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And he has an article at The Guardian. The government promised to clamp down on shell companies. It has failed to do so. And the government, of course, you're writing about in The Guardian article, is the UK government of Boris Johnson. And he's an overall disappointment, to put it mildly, is he not? Some people think he's more of an entertainer and a clown than a politician, certainly, and a statesman. So it shouldn't be that surprising, right, that he's dropped the ball on this?
No, it's not. I mean, you're right. He is a disappointment, though I suppose, you know, that presupposes whether anyone had any illusions about him to begin with, which I'm not sure I did. But, you know, I mean, in his defense, obviously, all governments around the world have a lot of demands on their time right now with tackling the pandemic and, in his case, leaving the European Union, though that's a bit of a self-inflicted blow, I suppose. You know, but what is dispiriting is that his predecessors as prime minister did promise to make some, you know, some very significant reforms that would have helped prevent the UK being this major centre for laundering and sheltering kleptocratic loot that it has become over the last few decades. And they would have been good ideas, you know, reforms that would have made a big difference to changing the picture. But he's shelved them quietly. And so, you know, we have a very large quantity of property in the UK, which is owned offshore, particularly in the more sort of upscale parts of West London and the areas around London that are called the home counties. You know, and it would be really fascinating to shed light on the true owners of those properties. We know that lots of friends of Vladimir Putin like to own properties there, but I'm sure that lots of other kleptocrats from other places all around the world do so as well. You know, he has shelved that reform. That isn't going ahead. So that is a real shame. And the UK would be in a strong position to do something about it. But, you know, as we were saying earlier, this isn't just a UK issue. Sadly, this is an international issue. It isn't something that's in the gift of any one country to do something about. And, you know, looking across the Atlantic at the US, obviously, Joe Biden was a home state of Delaware, remains a very significant incorporation haven where many rich individuals and rich corporations like to put their headquarters because of its corporate secrecy. You know, other countries that have other issues in this regard, places like Luxembourg or Cyprus in the EU. You know, sadly, it isn't just one place that needs to shape up its act, but, you know, everywhere does. But you know, any one country does it, that will be in and of itself a good thing. And since I'm sitting in the UK, I thought I'd beat up on Boris Johnson for a bit rather than anyone else.
So the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, Pandora Papers, just to touch on South Dakota, they revealed that more than $13 million is tucked away in South Dakota by one of Guatemala's most powerful families allied to a particularly murderous Guatemalan general. The other highlights, of course, are a $22 million shadow in the French Riviera, owned by the Czech Republic's populist prime minister, who's a billionaire, and he of course campaigned and got elected, railing against corruption and political elites. I don't know whether that hypocrisy could possibly bring him down. And then in the case of another kleptocrat, who was the King of Jordan, he purchased three beachfront mansions in Malibu, near where I'm broadcasting from, through these shell companies offshore, for $68 million. And of course, that could resonate in this very poor and stressed country of Jordan. So what kind of blowback do you expect, Oliver?
Well, you know, we'd like to think that there will be, you know, significant repercussions. But I suppose looking at the kind of repercussions that followed the previous giant leaks, the Panama Papers and so on, I suspect possibly we should temper our expectations. You know, where were there significant repercussions back then? Well, Iceland had a political upheaval when it was revealed that one of its politicians had money, you know, offshore. There was some, you know, various bit of fuss made in the UK about the then Prime Minister David Cameron having, or his, I think his father had wealth offshore or so on. But, you know, more broadly, actually, politicians seem to be surprisingly good at riding out these storms. Particularly in places with, you know, a controlled media or a compliant, you know, legislative and judicial process like in Russia. So, you know, I wouldn't expect too much from it, I'd have to say. I would like to think that there will be more of a response than there will be. But I worry that we're all getting a bit blasé. We, you know, we see this and think, oh, well, shrug, we know that. We know they're up to all these sort of tricks. And that's where the harm is being done, because you cannot, you know, maintain a democratic political process without trust in the viability of the process. If, you know, we just expect our politicians, our political leaders, you know, to abuse their positions, to steal money and to hide it offshore, then, you know, essentially the trust that underpins democracy is gone. And that, once lost, is a very difficult thing to regain. And I think our politicians need to be a bit careful what they wish for here. I think it's time that someone actually, you know, came out and recognized the damage this is doing to the system.
Well, but you could argue that the fallout from the Panama Papers was immense, in as much as apparently Vladimir Putin blamed Hillary Clinton for the Panama Papers. And that's when he decided to use all these active measures to help elect Trump, even though Trump had been on the KGB's back burner since 1987 as a kind of trusted contact, or a useful idiot probably is a better description. But he apparently decided to pull the trigger and actively support Trump and hurt Hillary Clinton because of the Panama Papers.
Well, I mean, I don't, calling Donald Trump anyone's trusted contact is probably going a bit far, but I mean, there are many explanations for why Vladimir Putin so disliked Hillary Clinton. I don't think we need to look for, you know, one issue such as this. I mean, and I would say probably a more probable explanation would be the way that, you know, she egged on, if that's the word, the protesters who marched against, you know, Putin and his favored party, United Russia, in large numbers back in 2011. You know, there are many different aspects. There are many reasons why he would have preferred Donald Trump in the White House to Hillary Clinton. Not that in the end it did him much good, actually, either way, in terms of changes in US policy. But, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I think if the Panama Papers did have an effect, it was more in helping to inform this sort of general disquiet about the health of democracy, this general sort of corrosive distrust that is spreading in most, if not all, Western countries about the sort of probity of our political elites, and this feeling that essentially everyone's on the take, and that there is no, you know, good guy or good girl out there anymore who's looking out for ordinary people. You know, I think that is, you know, the lesson that many people took from Panama Papers, and I'd say this latest leak will probably just, you know, make that a more prevalent feeling, because, you know, if 5 years on, essentially nothing has changed, nothing has been done in response to the giant scandals that were exposed, you know, in 2016, then to be honest, you know, distrust and apathy and cynicism probably are rational responses to that, really.
But Oliver, is that to say that Putin and this Czech leader, who's turned out to be a massive hypocrite with his French chateau, who ran on a populist platform of attacking corrupt political elites? Surely Putin is sensitive about the estimated $160 billion that he holds. And I don't know, you know, I would have thought that naming and shaming would be useful. It may not do the trick, but it's useful. And in fact, in this current tranche of revelations from the Pandora Papers, one of the people around Putin is his image maker and propagandist, Konstantin Ernst, who's got, what, $160 million stashed away offshore?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, Putin is sensitive. He's particularly sensitive to allegations that he himself is engaged in corruption. The film that Alexei Navalny made of him, showing this astonishing, elaborate palace that someone had built on his behalf on the shores of the Black Sea, you know, was definitely one of the triggers that led to the latest, you know, crackdown on the anti-corruption or opposition inside Russia. You know, but does it really affect the political process in Russia in general, the specific allegations? I don't know. I mean, I haven't lived in Russia for several years, but I've rarely lived anywhere where the general population had a lower opinion of their political class, or a sort of essentially a higher expectation of wrongdoing by their political class. I mean, this is more ammunition for everyone in Russia to think that their politicians are corrupt and grotesquely kleptocratic mafia clan. But I think they probably all thought that anyway. I continue to think that these kind of revelations are of greater significance in Western countries, in the UK and the US and European Union nations, where hopefully they may inspire a bit of a movement to bring transparency to our financial system, to bring better enforcement of our existing financial regulations, particularly in the UK and the EU. That would be where I'd really hope to see change. I think expecting change, particularly after the disastrous parliamentary elections we've just seen in Russia, expecting change in places like Russia to come from this is wishful thinking. Sadly, I don't think it's likely.
So just in that last minute then, in expecting change in terms of reform that's possible with the at least with the Western countries and the democracies, clearly the idea is to expose who the beneficial owner is, right? These offshore tax havens put layers between the beneficial owner and the shell companies.
Yeah, exactly. They essentially allow people to operate, you know, behind a screen to make it look like they don't own something, or they're not, that it's a legitimate business acting rather than an individual. And this is an issue that has crept up the political agenda in many countries, including in the US, where, you know, a new law was passed very early this year, actually, to try and create some form of corporate transparency in the US. The US has been a real international laggard on this particular question. And I'm quite looking forward to this Summit of Democracies, which is scheduled from the State Department in December, which is supposed to have a tackling corruption really at the heart of what it's talking about. And I'd really hope to see that this giant leak will drive a bit of thought in properly cleaning up our financial system for the good of democracy, because it's desperately needed.
Well, Oliver Bulow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Oliver Bulow, who's in the UK. He's a journalist and regular contributor to The Guardian, The New York Times, and GQ. He's authored two non-fiction books about Russian history and politics, The Last Man in Russia and Let Our Fame Be Great. And his latest book is Moneyland, Why Thieves and Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And he has an article at The Guardian, The Government Promised to Clamp Down on Shell Companies. It has failed to do so. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the devastating oil spill off Huntington Beach in Southern California, in which 126,000 gallons from an offshore platform's broken oil pipeline has spilled into the ocean, killing fish and birds and threatening marine mammals, breeding grounds, and ecosystems.
Bermuda in the Bahamas, Front Street, Hamilton. They're doing more than growing bananas. They got a tax dodge going on. Offshore banking business,
international crime.
Offshore banking business,
happening all the time.
Banks and corporations are registered and operating there.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gwen Goodman-Lowe, who's a lecturer in the Marine Biology Department at Long Beach State University. She's an expert on marine mammals. Specifically, her research focuses on the effects of contaminants on seals, whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gwen Goodman-Lowe.
Thank you very much.
So, Gwen, the massive oil spill off Huntington Beach, where an estimated 126,000 gallons of oil has leaked into the ocean about 6 miles offshore between Huntington Beach Pier and Newport Beach in Southern California. The pipeline is operated by Beta Offshore. And at this point, we're told that most of the damage to marine life is happening with birds. But what do you know, since obviously you're quite near the scene?
That's what I've been reading as well and seeing on the news, that it's mainly birds that are washing up on shore covered in oil. So what we don't know really is what's happening with marine mammals. And my guess is that fish are also going to be affected.
And the oil company has said that there's no more oil leaking, but they haven't determined where the leak comes from yet, right?
Right, that's correct. So as of yesterday, I read that they did not have it completely fixed. So I'm not really sure, you know, how they can determine that, but I'm sure they have their ways. So, but that doesn't mitigate the fact that there's a lot of oil that's been spilled all along our coast that they now have to clean up.
Well, the mayor of Huntington Beach has described the situation as a potential ecological disaster. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that on a local scale, yes.
Meaning what? What do you mean a local scale? In other words...
Well, so it's 6 miles of shoreline, right? So it's not like it's all along our coast, you know, in a very large area. And it is in the Pacific Ocean, which means that the waves will carry a lot of that oil away. And when it's carried away in such a large volume, going into a large volume, it will be dissipated. So it's an ecological disaster on a local scale for sure. And part of the reason is because the oil has gotten into the Talbot Marsh, which is a very low wave energy protected environment. And so anytime you have oil spill going into the marsh area, which is an area where, you know, you have a lot of animals that are protected from exposure to the environment, and there are nursery grounds for growing, you know, for developing organisms, fish, invertebrates, things like that, birds also. And it's very hard to get the oil out of there once it gets in because you don't have a lot of flushing from the waves. So you're affecting very young organisms and breeding organisms in those marshes. And that's really the worst part of this, I would say, rather than it being bad on a large scale. But once it gets into those protected marshes, it's really hard to get rid of the oil then.
And how far into these marshes has it gone?
I don't know. I don't really know. I haven't seen any reports about that, but I know that it has gotten into at least one marsh, and I know they're trying really hard to prevent it from going in there. So, but I don't know how far I haven't seen pictures of how far into the marsh the oil has gotten.
But there are a number of protected marshlands in that area, are there not?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm.
And what one of them has been contaminated?
As far as I know, it's only Talbot Marsh right now, but I haven't seen any reports of other ones. But the potential is there for it to get into any of those marshes that are, you know, really important nursery grounds for developing organisms at all levels.
Well, this company, Beta Offshore, they were responsible for a 2,000-gallon oil spill in 2000 for which they were fined. But it turns out that in Huntington Beach, if you go back to 1990, there was a 416,000-gallon oil leak into the ocean. And then, of course, there was one at Refugio State Beach in 2015, which leaked 100,000 gallons of oil. So is there an inventory or an understanding of how many undersea oil pipelines there are off the coast of Southern California? Because you've got a lot of them you see off Santa Barbara and Ventura and off Long Beach as well. So,
right.
What do we know about the number of pipelines, the conditions of these pipelines? Apparently, this company is troubled. It's been in and out of bankruptcy. So I'm wondering about what kind of responsibility there is and what kind of government oversight exists.
Right. I mean, I can't speak to that because it's not my field at all. I'm really a biologist, not a petrochemical person. So I can't really speak to that, but it is of some concern. I mean, there's, you know, these platforms were built a long time ago and they have to be maintained, and they are maintained all the time. But when you have ocean water and pipes, you know, you have to assume that these pipes are going to degrade over time. And I'm sure that they're not inspecting every inch of those pipes all the time, because it would probably be impossible, especially at that depth. So you are going to have problems like this that come up.
And again, I'm speaking with Gwen Goodman-Lowe, who's a lecturer in the Marine Biology Department at Long Beach State University. She's an expert on marine mammals. Specifically, her research focuses on the effects of contaminants on seals, whales, dolphins, and porpoises. Well, we know that they haven't been able to locate where this actual leak of this pipeline is. I guess they've sent divers down. I assume that what happened was they cut off the pipeline flow from the well underneath the ocean, so there's no more leaking, but everything that was in the pipeline obviously leaked out. So right. Does that mean that there'll be more damage than what we've seen so far, or has it reached its peak?
That's a really good question. And part of that is related to the wave action. So we can't really determine that. There's almost no way to determine that. And the more waves we get, and over time, even if some oil is still leaking out, if there's wave action, it's going to bring that oil out to sea. So we won't really know, if that makes sense. There's not really a way to say, oh, in 3 days it's going to be worse than it is today, because it depends so much on the action of the waves and the currents and things like that. So we're not really sure.
Well, apparently there's some attempt to, I don't know how you recapture the oil, but there are apparently 14 boats out there with booms. So they've recovered 3,200 gallons with a 5,360-foot boom. But I guess that doesn't work if the ocean gets rough, right?
Right, that's correct. So the booms are in place to prevent the oil from seeping out into a larger area or into a certain place. So if you've ever been to a marina and you've seen, you know, a boom around the back of a boat, that boat probably has some kind of fuel leak, and they're trying to prevent the oil from getting into the rest of the marina. So that's pretty much how booms work. They're just a flotation device that you put on the water itself, and that prevents the oil that's floating on the water from getting out farther. But that only works if the water is calm. If there's any kind of wave action or swells or anything like that, the booms don't really work. So it's really a containment. It's a way of containing the oil from getting out farther into the ocean. But then they also have to collect the oil, get rid of it, and there's a bunch of different ways that they can do that.
So what happens to marine mammals when they ingest oil?
It's pretty bad. So they can get lung infections. If they survive the initial oil spill, they can get skin lesions. It can affect their immune systems. They have immune suppression. They can have reproductive impairment down the line. So it's not great for any species, but marine mammals as well.
Well, so there's potential, though, for more of these oil leaks, because there are some 23 oil and gas drilling platforms in federal waters off the California coastline. So
definitely, yes. I was going to say the problem with these oil spills is that, you know, we see the immediate effects, like birds being covered with oil, and we try to, you know, we bring them into captivity and get the oil off. But what we don't see are the long-term effects. It takes, you know, many years to see the long-term effects, because we don't know how the oil has affected their reproduction or their susceptibility to disease. We kind of do know that it does those things, but as far as like population numbers, we won't really know how this specific oil spill is going to affect the populations of those organisms that are affected until, you know, several years down the line.
But you were saying earlier that so far the victims of this oil spill have been largely fish and birds. So,
well, that's what we've seen. So we haven't seen any marine mammals, you know, affected yet, but that doesn't mean anything. It's just that the immediate ones that we've seen are birds.
And are the gray whales migrating at this moment?
The gray whales, let's see, it's pretty early for them, so probably not, but we do have other whales off our coast. We have humpback whales and blue whales, and sometimes we get killer whales down here, so there are, and we have a lot of dolphins as well, so we do have marine mammal species that are in the area.
So the birds then, are they washing up? Is that, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how, as a marine biologist, you and your colleagues collect the evidence here.
Right. So, yeah, so the birds are covered in oil, and they're on the beaches because they can't fly because the oil is too heavy for them to fly. So that's why we can see the birds. You know, that's like the immediate one, is that we can see the birds that are covered in oil. For the fish, you're just going to see, you know, there might be a big fish kill, dead fish washing up. But since the fish are out in the open water, a lot of times we don't see the death of them immediately, like we see the birds. Same thing with the marine mammals. Since they can get out of the way, we don't know which marine mammals have been affected and where they are. There could be ones that have died but haven't washed up on the beaches, so we wouldn't really see that right away.
Well, apparently, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom, who recently survived a recall rather successfully, he wants to end oil drilling in the state of California by 2045. And apparently, it's gone down quite a bit since the 1990s.
Well, I mean, you know, that's one thing that people in Southern California especially have to think about is where we get our energy from. We're all pretty much addicted to our cars, right? We don't have a lot of public transportation here like we have in places like New York City. And so how do we get around? We have to use cars. And what cars do we use? We use gas-powered cars, right? So we have to think about those things. If we want these oil spill accidents to stop, that means we have to get our reliance on other types of energy like solar power or wind power or, you know, things like that, water turbines.
Well, Huntington Beach, of course, has been the site of a number of pro-Trump demonstrations, largely to do with, you know, refusal to wear masks and refusal to get vaccinated. It's the area that's affected. It's represented by a Republican congresswoman, U.S. Representative Michelle Steele. She's called upon Democratic President Joe Biden to make a disaster declaration for Orange County. Is this likely? And of course, there's a popular air show had to be canceled in Huntington Beach. Is this likely to affect the politics of the region, that people in Huntington Beach will become more conscious of the environment and threats to the environment?
That's a good question. That's a great question. I wish I could answer that. One could only hope, but I don't really know.
Well, it's getting national attention. It's, you know, right across the country. Mm-hmm. People are. Mm-hmm. It's a leading story in most newspapers around the country. So at least it's the rest of the countries are being informed of it. And,
right.
And just in the last couple of minutes, then, tell me about what kind of groups and assets have been organized to deal with this apart from the Coast Guard.
Well, of course, we have the all of the animal rescue sites, right? So there's the Huntington Beach Bird Rescue. There's San Pedro Bird Rescue. I'm sure they're getting some of the animals. There's also two marine mammal training centers in our area. One is in San Pedro and one is in Laguna. So if any marine mammals get stranded from the oil, they'll be taking those. So there's a lot of rescue groups that are involved in trying to help the animals with the oil spills. And of course, then we have researchers that are, you know, their research is going to be affected, and maybe there'll be grant money for them to study these things and try to get better measures put in place for restoration.
Well, just in terms of finishing up here with some, you know, roughly good news,
sure.
There have been no new drilling permits issued since the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And Senator Dianne Feinstein proposed a bill in January that would permanently bar the federal government from allowing new leases. And during the Trump administration, of course, Trump tried to get rid of all federal oversight over offshore drilling. So at least this one is a disaster, obviously, for Huntington Beach and Newport Beach, but there may be fewer of them in the future, if that's
right.
A positive note to end on.
You know, we really have to look towards the future and different technologies in order to get our energy, because this is going to happen over and over again if we don't reduce our reliance on fossil fuels.
Well, Gwen Goodman-Lowe, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Gwen Goodman-Lowe, who's a lecturer in the Marine Biology Department at Long Beach State University. She's an expert on marine mammals. Specifically, her research focuses on the effects of contaminants on seals, whales, dolphins, and porpoises. We're going to take a brief station break and back trying to figure out why Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp are down today and assess the impact of the 60 Minutes appearance on Sunday night by Frances Haugen, a Facebook data scientist and whistleblower.
Don't go near the water. Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by me. Life on land.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Jonathan Taplin, an author and director emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, who has produced music and film for Bob Dylan and the band, George Harrison, Martin Scorsese, Wim Wenders, Gus Van Sant, and many others. He's the founder of The Entertainer, the first streaming video on demand platform in 1996, and currently sits on the boards of the Authors Guild, Americana Music Association, and the Los Angeles Mayor's Council on Technology and Innovation. And he's the author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And his latest book is The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be here, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, were among the first to alert the public to both the dangers that Facebook poses to our economy as a monopoly and the dangers it poses to our society as this very, very powerful platform that operates without any social responsibility. And this is what has been exposed just on Sunday night on 60 Minutes by a Facebook data scientist. So let's begin with the exposure of the inner workings of Facebook and what this data scientist considers to be its irresponsible abandonment of safeguards that they had placed on their platform designed to thwart misinformation and arousing political passions prior to the elections. But once Donald Trump was defeated, they took away these safeguards. And the data scientist, Frances Haugen, she basically saying that that decision led to the deadly January the 6th invasion of the U.S. Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, because essentially, if you change the algorithm to make Facebook more safe, as she said, they will lose money. In other words, Facebook makes money by encouraging publishers to put out the most angry, supposedly engaging content possible. And the more angry and the more divisive the content, the longer people stay on Facebook, and obviously the more advertising Facebook is able to sell. So when they made some changes just in the month and a half before the election, they probably started losing the money. And literally the day after the election, they changed the algorithm back to the old way it was, which was allowing the more hateful, divisive content. And of course, their revenues went up. And that, of course, led to the kind of content that spurred the January 6th, revolt.
Well, why are they so money-driven? Because they are so successful. Facebook's revenues have doubled from $56 billion in 2018 to $119 billion this year. And its market cap has gone up from $375 billion at the end of 2018 to nearly $1 trillion today. So they are not short of a few bucks.
Yeah, but look, these people are libertarians. And you know, Peter Thiel, who is obviously a great Donald Trump supporter and who I believe is behind a lot of these decisions being made, he's on the board of Facebook. He was Zuckerberg's first outside investor, believes that democracy and freedom are not compatible. And he wants to be on the side of freedom. And freedom to him means that anybody should be able to say anything they want, and Facebook should be a platform to use that as a megaphone. And, you know, I thought the most astonishing thing Frances Haugen said was that she thought that Facebook should declare moral bankruptcy. And what she meant by that was they have to stop and start all over again because it is so toxic. It's not just the Rohingya Muslim issues, or it's not just the hate speech that leads to a January 6th. It's not just the fact that if you consume most of your news on the vaccinations from Facebook, you're more unlikely to get a vaccine than if you got it from, say, the New York Times. All of these things are contributing to, as I said many years ago, the demise of democracy. And these people don't care about that. And they don't want to stop making money. Their whole idea is to grow faster and faster and faster. And so the fact that their market cap rose so much, that their revenues doubled in 2 years, is something that they're proud of. And they want to keep it going. They don't want to slow it down at all.
Well, what's slowing them down today, Monday, is the fact that Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram have been down for several hours. Nobody quite knows why. Do you have any idea what's happening to the platforms?
Yeah, my guess is a hacker took them down, or a group of hackers. I think that the kind of notion that this company just is immune to criticism. You know, they knew this was all coming because this woman leaked it to the Wall Street Journal 3 weeks ago. And so, you know, their reaction from Nick Clegg and all the other spokespeople on Facebook was, this is a nothing burger. There's no big deal that this is happening and that these actions and we don't hurt girls on Instagram and all this nonsense. And so somebody probably was angry enough to just say, well, take the whole thing offline.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Taplin, an author and director emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, who's produced music and film for Bob Dylan and the band, George Harrison, Martin Scorsese, Wim Wenders, Gus Van Sant, and many others. And he's the founder of The Entertainer, the first streaming video on demand platform in 1996, and currently sits on the boards of the Authors Guild, Americana Music Association, and Los Angeles Mayor's, the Los Angeles Mayor's Council on Technology and Innovation. And he's the author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And his latest book is The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. Well, on Monday, Facebook filed a motion to dismiss the Federal Trade Commission's antitrust suit against the company, saying that the FTC lacked evidence. Lina Khan, of course, is the new head of the FTC. During the Trump administration, we had Dracula in charge of the blood bank, but now she is basically doing her job and arguing that the mergers that Facebook have with Instagram and WhatsApp are, in fact, what she calls buy or bury competition, and that Facebook, in fact, should be broken up. So what are the chances of that succeeding?
Well, if you look at the statistics, Facebook controls 4 of the top 5 social networks in the world. The only one they don't control is YouTube. And so it would seem to me that Lina Khan has a very good argument. And the fact that she would like Facebook to sell Instagram and to sell WhatsApp is probably one solution. But I'm not positive it's the solution that would change the issues that Frances Haugen is talking about. And that is, Facebook has no problem putting unbelievable amounts of disinformation. Their own research showed that only 0.6% of violent content gets screened out by their own internal algorithms. So, I mean, they're not even paying the least bit of attention to it. So what would change things would be to remove the safe harbor protections that Facebook has. In other words, the United States government at the beginning of the internet age gave Facebook, Google, Twitter, YouTube a liability protection called safe harbor, which meant that no one could sue Facebook for anything that was on its platform under the mistaken assumption that Facebook had no control over any content on their platform. In other words, that it was just this neutral force that put up everything that was posted to Facebook, which is nonsense. As you well know, there's no pornography on Facebook. Facebook filters out hundreds of hours of pornography every day. The same with YouTube. There's no longer any jihadist beheading videos on YouTube and Facebook, where there used to be those all the time, because their algorithms search out and filter out that content. So when, you know, the Dominion voting machine company was slandered by the Trump campaign and then Fox News and Newsmax a few months ago, Dominion sued Newsmax and Fox News. And within a week, both those organizations posted retractions of what they had said about that the Dominion voting machines had switched votes from Trump to Biden, and apologized, and even ran, you know, Chiron saying that. But no, Facebook is far more wider audience than either, you know, Fox News or Newsmax. I mean, when Tucker Carlson is on Fox News at night, he's lucky if he gets 2 million people to watch him. But on Facebook and YouTube, he gets tens of millions of people to watch him every night in terms of these little clips that get reposted on Facebook and YouTube. And by the way, Fox News knows that only the most ridiculous stuff should be posted on Facebook, the stuff that will get the most outrage and i.e. retain the most viewer attraction, as they call it, engagement. And so it's really, this is a very irresponsible company. And in some ways, it's a net negative. I mean, in my mind, I thought if Facebook had been around in 1955, we'd still have polio. And that's the kind of irresponsibility this society can't really deal with anymore.
So, Jonathan Tablin, in the last few minutes, your book, Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, as I say, was one of the first to raise a lot of these questions that are now being debated. And by the way, Francis Haugen will be testifying to Congress this week. And I mentioned the FCC case as well. But I think the strongest case of all comes from the fact that these social media sites, WhatsApp and Snapchat and TikTok, and in particular Instagram, they are used by drug dealers to merchandise to young Americans. And just last week, the Drug Enforcement Administration issued a warning to the country, and particularly to parents, that 2 out of 5 of the pills available that are sold and advertised over these platforms, they're counterfeit pills laced with fentanyl. 2 out of 5 have lethal doses of fentanyl, and young kids don't have the tolerance for hard drugs, so they're dying in droves. This is murder on a large scale, almost like the same that you could charge the Sackler family of Purdue Pharma, and they in fact created the gateway drug to allow fentanyl and these others to flood the market. This is happening right now, and it's happening under the same rubric that you wrote about, which is what Section 230 of the Federal Communications Act that came in under Clinton, which allows these people to avoid the responsibility of being publishers and being responsible for their content. So if they're killing people, I would think that that should get people's attention perhaps more than what happened on 60 Minutes on Sunday night with the Facebook whistleblower.
Well, look, they've been killing people all year. I mean, every time Robert F. Kennedy Jr. gets access to millions of people via his Facebook account and tells people not to take the vaccine, he's essentially condemning people to death. So, I mean, these people don't have any responsibility. And quite honestly, Ian, it's the triumph of the libertarians. And, you know, I talked about that a lot in my book in 2016, and nobody really understood what I really meant. But these people have a fanatical notion that if you want to take fentanyl, that's your liberty. You have a liberty to do that. And I, as a owner, Peter Thiel, as an owner of Facebook, which he is, don't have any responsibility to tell you not to do that. If you want to be an idiot, you can do it.
And right, but we're talking about teenage kids taking what they think is Xanax or Adderall and right. dying.
Yeah, but I mean, and Peter Thiel and Mark Zuckerberg are making a lot of money out of it. So, I mean, this is, we've got to really rethink this notion of liberty and free speech, because they're pretending that their job is to protect free speech. And this is nonsense. This is the equivalent of shouting fire in a crowded theater. If you're killing people by selling fentanyl or telling people not to get vaccinated or telling people that Trump is really the president and all of this. And so something has got to change. And my simple explanation is if people could sue Facebook for disinformation, for libel, for just telling lies, they might really get their act together and start policing their content a lot better than they are now.
Well, Jonathan Taplin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, who's an author and director emeritus of the USC Annenberg Innovation Lab, who has produced music and film for Bob Dylan and the band, George Harrison, Martin Scorsese, Wim Wenders, Gus Van Sant, and many others. And he's the founder of The Entertainer, the first streaming video on-demand platform in 1996, and currently sits on the boards of the Authors Guild, Americana Music Association, and the Los Angeles Mayor's Council on Technology and Innovation. And he's the author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Facebook, Google, and Amazon Have Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And his latest book is The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. When we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now.
The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.